For carnivores, again, if we wanted to meet their nutritional requirements, we could probably just feed a meat product that would meet that. But that is not going to support a lot of those behaviors. That's not going to support, you know, that doesn't really give them, if it's like a ground meat product, it's not going to give them that tearing and ripping and sort of sensory experience. So we offer a lot of whole prey. So things like rabbits, where the animals can really get into that and exhibit those behaviors. We'll also do meaty bones. So bones that they can chew on and get some of that meat off, but also really exercise those jaw muscles.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Corbion's Alga Prime DHA P3, the algae-based omega-3 DHA to boost brain cognition, immune system, and well-being. Adding it to pet food is easier than ever. Bioregion, your partner in yeast ingredients for palatability, immunity, and nutrition. Complete solutions for every pet diet. Learn about the benefits of working with Schooler. Visit schooler.com/pet. That's schooler.com/pet. Young Generation Oral and Gut Health Solutions with antibodies from egg yolk. IGY technology. Research-driven. Pet-approved.
Hello, and welcome to the Pet Food Science Podcast, where we'll take a deep dive into the science, trends, and innovations shaping the way that we feed our pets. Whether you're a pet owner, an industry professional, or simply interested in learning more about what goes into your pet's diet, this space is for you. I'm your host, Dr. Kate Shoveler. I'm a professor of companion animal nutrition at the University of Guelph with a background in comparative animal nutrition and a passion for understanding how evidence-based approaches can improve our health and well-being of our animals and enhance our own lives. I'm excited for today's podcast. Today, we have Dr. Heidi Bissell, the lead nutritionist at Disney Animal Kingdom. We will be exploring how zoo and exotic animal nutritionists approach feeding these animals when we have little empirical estimates of nutrient requirements. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. So happy to be here.
Well, how about we start, because you do have a pretty darn cool job. And I'm sure that the listeners and especially the trainees would love to know how you ended up there. Would you mind sharing a little bit of your history and how you landed at Disney Animal Kingdom?
So I'll start at the very beginning, which is I was a nerdy student who loved science and biology. And I went to school and people said, oh, you love animals and you're great at science. You should be a vet. And so I went through undergrad sure that I wanted to be a veterinarian. And so I worked for vets and I volunteered for vets and I did all sorts of things. And I honestly found it rather boring. Apologies to any vets out there, but I didn't find it as interesting as I thought it would. I think I would have loved vet school, but not so much the day-to-day of vaccinating cats and dogs all day. But what I did find is that a lot of nutrition questions came up. And especially when I worked for a wildlife hospital, pretty much if an animal wasn't hit by a car, then the other reason it was there was because it had some sort of nutritional issue. So there were iguanas without bones and birds with all sorts of deficiencies and things like that. And the vets would always just tell people, well, you should feed them a better diet. And the clients would ask, like what? And the vets would be like, I don't know. You just have to research what they eat and, you know, do your best. This is a little bit pre-internet. I'm kind of old. But I was fascinated. Like, somebody should know what to feed these animals and somebody should do that. And of course, I've always been of the philosophy that if you say somebody should, then it's probably you. So I was sitting in class in an avian ecology class, and I suddenly sat up and I was like, the professor studies bird nutrition. And I was just like, hey, like I could study bird nutrition with you in the middle of class. So that was how I kind of got into the field. I ended up taking a lot of nutrition classes, and then I ran off and joined the Peace Corps. Because I wasn't quite sure. I did get accepted to vet school, but then I declined. So I did the Peace Corps for 2 years, something completely different, although I did work at a wildlife reserve and helped with some of the science they were doing. And then I came back and I did my master's in animal nutrition with a focus on wildlife health and ended up being with ruminants. I did that at the University of Florida. And then after I graduated, I went and worked with giant pandas for 4 years at the Memphis Zoo. They had just gotten in giant pandas as part of their program. And all the zoos that had giant pandas at the time specialized in a certain area of biology. So San Diego was working on reproduction and Atlanta was working on behavior. And Memphis chose to focus on nutrition. So it was a big role, although you would think pandas only eat one thing. How hard could the nutrition of an animal that eats one thing be? And it turns out it's very complex. They eat different parts. They eat different varieties in the different seasons. And their digestion is fascinating because they're eating this really woody plant and it goes through them very quickly. And so they're getting what I call the grass stain out of this plant. You know, they're just getting the little tiniest, most digestible bits. So that makes them, they are carnivores in the sense that they're order carnivora, but they eat a plant, but then they digest like a carnivore. It's fascinating. So I did that for 4 years. And then I went to go get my PhD, did that at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. And I did my PhD work in China with the black and white snub-nosed monkey. And so I loved working in China. So I did finally get to China with a black and white animal, just not the panda that I had originally thought that I would be going to work on. And so I spent 4 years studying the nutrition of the snub-nosed monkey, which is the highest altitude living primate and eats lichen, which is a very unusual food source. And then I came back and I started working at Busch Gardens and SeaWorld for 10 years. I was there and they have a fascinating animal collection. And I really got into the research and big data of looking across our collection for health trends and things like that to look at nutritional issues and how nutrition influences health. And then the position at Disney opened up just under 3 years ago and I applied. And now I'm at Disney with our wonderful collection here with a great team of people that we're doing all sorts of really cool nutritional stuff. So it's been a great fit.
84 million times a day, pets eat meals with ingredients from Trow Nutrition. We bring together the science of ingredients, nutrition, and blending to unleash possibilities for pet food brands. Premixes are just the start. Turn to Trow for higher inclusion ingredients too, like proteins and carbohydrates, and highly sensitive ingredients like probiotics. With our palatants and base blends, you can feel confident about what comes in our bags and goes in yours. Learn more at TrowNutritionPets.com.
Just from your introduction, I have a litany of questions. And I have to ask one because I can't hold myself back. But I have no idea what nutrients are in lichen. Can you share what the nutrient composition of lichen is? Because I don't know.
So it's a symbiotic between a fungus and a microbe. And so it has a lot of the nutritional properties of like mushrooms. But then lichens also are well known for their toxins, which some of the blue-green algae provides. And some of those are powerful antibiotics. So lichens are used a lot in microbial research. The monkey I was studying is a foregut fermenting monkey, which means it's like a cow with microbial fermentation in the gut. And then they eat this thing with antibiotic properties, which was fascinating. But the nitrogen that's in lichen is not so much protein as much as it is a lot of non-protein amino acids. And so you kind of need that foregut fermentation in order to turn it into usable protein, which is why really only ruminants like reindeer and pseudo-ruminants like some of these, well, they're not really pseudo-ruminants, but they have this foregut fermentation, these monkeys, can really eat it.
Interesting. Is it not really difficult for the animal to procure, harvest the lichen? Do they do that by licking?
Everywhere where they live. It's in every tree, tons of it.
Oh, okay. So it's just a lot more abundant. I guess I have a North American perspective where I'm thinking it's not that prevalent. Fascinating. Well, that kind of brings us really, maybe if you could dimensionalize for the listeners, you feed a variety of animals at Disney Animal Kingdom. And how exactly, and maybe use a couple of examples of animals that have really diverse or unusual food requirements. How do you choose these food sources? And just to start, and then we'll dive into how do you assess how those animals are performing with those food sources?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously we have a huge diversity of animals from sort of your our large carnivores. We have tigers and lions that are eating meat. And then we have a huge number of herbivores. And some of those, like say zebra, are grazers eating grass. So they can graze on a savanna, which is challenging in and of itself because they, you know, we have to sample that every so often, but it's hard to know exactly what they're eating. And that changes throughout the year. But then we also have a huge number here at Disney's Animal Kingdom of browsers, which are animals that eat leaves. So if you think of giraffe or gorillas, things like that, that just spend their day eating leaves. And so that's a more challenging thing to provide because you can't just go to a store or your feed store and purchase leaves. So we actually have a 90-acre farm where we grow a lot, but that's still not enough, especially because we're still far enough north that the winter production drops significantly. So we end up purchasing a lot of browse from down south, South Florida, so that we can have enough to make sure that our browsers have a good quantity of browse throughout the year. And it's really important for their health and physiology. It's really not the same composition as grass. So feeding things like hay just isn't as adequate.
Just to follow up on that, so I'm just curious because when you procure the browse from somewhere else, I imagine that it comes, shall we say, semi-processed.
I mean, it's the branches have been cut, but it's usually pretty fresh, just cut straight off the tree as whole branches full of leaves.
And
We get them in big bundles.
Interesting. And so my next question was, you know, do they still have the same action that they would have with a living standing tree? So whether, you know, with horses, we talk about the importance of feeding on the ground to kind of replicate grazing. But with a giraffe, it would be...
We hang it up in trees. Yep.
So you hang it in trees and they still pull it off of the branch.
Yep.
And so is that a really important part of the feeding experience? And this sounds a little bit more as a behavioral ingestive need.
It cuts across a lot of different needs for the animal. So nutritionally, it supports rumen function much better than grasses do. Leaves have a very different physiology. And it supports the production of saliva, which is sodium bicarbonate, which keeps the pH in the rumen correct. So it's important on that physiological level. And then behaviorally, when it's hanging in the tree and it's fixed up there, you know, we chain it up or tie it up in a way that they're still having to do that plucking behavior. And going for giraffe here, for gorillas, it might be different, but they do that plucking behavior where they wrap their tongue around a leaf and pull it off. And giraffe in the wild do that all day long. And they're eating out of thorn bushes. And so they're really taking that really nimble tongue and pulling out almost one leaf at a time. So this is what giraffe do, and this is what most of our browsers do, is they spend their day acquiring enough leafy material, and it's a huge part of their daily activity budget. And so being able to provide it in that way that they're still getting pieces at a time versus, say, you know, a pelleted diet, which they also do get pellets, but if we offered them just a pelleted diet, they could probably eat their entire day's caloric requirement in 15 minutes, which doesn't support good rumen function and doesn't support this behavioral aspect. This is a really important part for a lot of our animals, is that the physical process of acquiring it is what they're designed to do. And so giving them those opportunities to make those choices and to spend that time doing those behaviors is really important.
Interesting. How about, because I think you can probably tell where I'm going to ladder this question, but What about carnivores and the management of theirs?
So for carnivores, again, if we wanted to meet their nutritional requirements, we could probably just feed a meat product that would meet that. But that is not going to support a lot of those behaviors. That's not going to support, you know, that doesn't really give them, if it's like a ground meat product, it's not going to give them that tearing and ripping and sort of sensory experience. So we offer a lot of whole prey. So things like rabbits, where the animals can really get into that and exhibit those behaviors. We'll also do meaty bones. So bones that they can chew on and get some of that meat off, but also really exercise those jaw muscles. There's been some studies showing that wild animals have much beefier, even you can see it in the skeleton, like the beefier jaw muscles because of the crunching and stuff. And so we're really trying to replicate that by making sure they have a lot of those opportunities to get that exercise.
That's another interesting aspect. I didn't ladder it. I would have thought about dental health. I wouldn't have thought about mandibular strength as a surrogate, but that makes a lot of sense. So when we think about applying some of this knowledge around substrate, really, and how we present it, how can it's quite counterintuitive to me that we would feed our cats, maybe dogs a little less so, some evidence that they've adapted away from some aspects of their feral evolution or their wild evolution. But cats, there hasn't been as much change in their physiology. They're not quite as domesticated. Some people argue that the domestic cat doesn't fit the bill completely. How do you think that we could replicate that for our owned cats, our domestic cats that are in our families, so that they could have that feeding experience that builds their, really matches their, as you said earlier, their activity budget that would occur in the wild?
Yeah. So I think with domestic cats, there's a lot we can do to provide that experience, which I think starts with the whole hunting, stalking and hunting and everything. And that, you know, all the cat toys that are out there with, you know, the fishing wands and the little toy mice and stuff, really, they get that that chasing and pouncing and attacking kind of behaviors. But then when you get into the feeding, they make toys that you can, like little toy mice that you can put kibble in, and they can bat that around and kibble falls out. So it's a little bit, it's getting into that. And then I know some people actually will feed thawed frozen mice, you know, that you can get at the pet store to their cats to give that experience. Not a lot of cats will actually go through the effort. If they really haven't learned from their parent how to dismember a mouse, they probably aren't going to learn that, but some do.
Well, I'll have to this. I too had that opinion. Guido Bosch from Wageningen said, no, honest, they're going to eat these mice really quickly. So, spoiler alert, since it's not published, I'm not going to share the results, but, we did feed a bunch of our colony cats these mice, and we started by opening them up so the cats could kind of get the full flavor idea. But we had 14 cats eating mice in 3 days, and they were born in an SPF facility and had never been shown. And I was blown away. And there was one cat, Heidi, who the first day was like, oh, this is what I've been waiting for all of my life, and downed it in a very short period of time. It was quite fascinating. So surprisingly, they really adapt to it quickly. So I may or may not be one of those people who occasionally buy mice and feed them to my cat. Dead, humanely euthanized mice, but nevertheless, and they love it.
Yeah, I have tried with my domestic cats, and they have never even opening them up. But I know there are some, and clearly yours learned. I think it helps if they're younger. I think I might have started when they were senior citizens. And I love that as a sensory experience for a cat to be able to have that feeding behavior.
Yeah, I think the challenge for the pet food industry, and it should be right there. Why can't they replicate all the textures that would be needed in a prey item with foods that meet all the FDA guidelines for food safety, most important because they share houses with us. But that has got to be an innovation that someone in the food science community could figure out. So hopefully somebody has just run off and started to work on that.
I hope so. And I've always been hoping for a minced mouse flavor, you know, and they have like turkey dinner or something. I'm like, why isn't there minced mouse for a cat?
Hey, I also, by the way, I used to jokingly, when I was in industry, suggest that we should have a horse poop diet for dogs, because if anybody has dogs and rides horses, they like eating a lot of different types of poop, but they really like horse poop. It must be all those short chain fatty acids. I'm not sure if anyone has looked too far into it, but and they eat a lot of feral dogs eat a lot of human poop. So, you know, it's so interesting how we have these fascinating opinions about what they should eat, which is nothing that they actually want to eat. Right? So when you think about everything that you were talking about in terms of the food sources that different types of animals, zoo animals, exotic animals will eat, is there an aspect that's important for diversity? And is it diversity of the texture and how the food is eaten? Is it diversity of nutrients that they ingest? How important is diversity?
When I think about what animals eat in the wild, it is very rare that on a single day, they're going to eat more than a few different types of foods. They're eating what's in season. They're eating what's available. They're eating what's not being defended by predators. They're not eating an entire smorgasbord of the entire world. Now, across a year, they may eat dozens or in some cases hundreds of different foods. But on a given day, they don't eat that many different foods. So I think a lot of what we can do is work with sort of an annual calendar. Whereas I think most of us are much more familiar with, you know, either the same thing every day, but maybe like 20 different foods so that you're sure you covered everything by feeding the kitchen sink, which I don't agree with. I think that leads to really picky animals in my experience, because they can pick out the pieces that they like and they end up unbalancing their own diet. Or they get fed the same food day in and day out, which I think can lead to pickiness in a different direction, which is that they're scared of new foods. So I think what we're trying to move towards is a few items every day that, you know, over the course of a week or so balances nutritionally, but not necessarily every single day. And then incorporate that with, like, we have a behavior team that's working on all sorts of training and enrichment and encouraging animals to do the full repertoire of their natural behaviors. So if they're out there foraging, you know, some days some foods might better support the foraging aspect, some might better support that tearing aspect. And so, you know, we can alter the food throughout the week or across the year to encompass all of those different behaviors and give the animals lots of opportunities. So, you know, we're trying to find the right balance of variety where it's not too much, not too little, and it changes at the right speed so that our animals are willing to try new foods for their own sake, as well as sometimes there's a hiccup in the supply chain and you just need them to eat something else. And especially as we get more and more down the road of sustainability and sustainable things, you know, we might need to change suppliers. We need animals to be flexible and to eat new things. But at the same time, we need them to eat their diet and eat a balanced diet. And we're hoping that they have those opportunities to exhibit all those behaviors. So kind of mixing all of those goals leads us to a system where we're kind of doing more annual rotations than day to day or just offering everything at once.
Indeed, even with humans and the pets that share our houses, there's a little bit of diversity in that, probably a lot more in the human diet. I certainly, when an animal does not have to be on a certain diet, and I myself, I mean, we never, and the full disclosure is I have worked for the major pet food companies, and I don't solely feed anybody's food. And in fact, I'm constantly in switching. And I think that there's an aspect too, that if you translate this and you think about pet food, indeed, if we talk about neophobia and neophilia, that absolutely exists. So a really good reason you shouldn't keep your dog or cat on the same flavor and the same SKU of food is if they do get ill, it's going to be really hard to introduce something new, and they're going to have an adverse reaction in terms of their acceptance to the food that you did feed that they got sick on. And so when you have a healthy animal, feeding them different substrates, different and different complete diets on the market could very well be beneficial. Now, one thing that I have heard about some of the zoo animals is that there are periods of time where you actively change the frequency of feeding. So for an example, you may in some animals have a fast day. Is this true, and why would you do that?
A lot of zoos do use a fast day. We don't do that so much here for various reasons, but at the places that do use that, the idea is that some of these animals have that sort of gorge and fast lifestyle. Like if you think of lions and tigers, they're big animals who eat a big prey, gorge themselves, and then, don't eat for a couple days. And so it's kind of getting at that. There's some evidence that it helps with weight maintenance to have those longer periods of time for animals for whom that's in their physiology. It's definitely not done for smaller animals who do need to feed more frequently. But there's a lot of thought that goes into how that fits into training and behavior programs. And it makes sense for some institutions and it doesn't make sense for others. But it's a really interesting physiology of feeding animals who would gorge and fast, not in a gorge and fast manner.
Yeah. So when you say there's some you absolutely wouldn't want to fast, we're talking about animals like fructivores who are eating this highly available source of calories, right? And rapidly digested and absorbed.
And pretty much any animal who would normally eat daily is going to be fed daily. It's just in those cases where you have animals who do a big gorge and then in the wild they might not eat for even several days of. What are the benefits of maintaining that a similar kind of schedule versus feeding them every day like we would those other species?
Interesting. And just out of curiosity, because as I'm thinking about all the animals that you've discussed feeding, some of them are getting a large amount of their hydration from the actual food sources that they're eating. But a lot of the animals that you're talking about need to also consume a large amount of water for, I'll kind of switch in this manner and say probably the amount of dry matter that they're eating. Just curious, is there thought at the zoos behind that too? So the water source, the food source, how maybe they're positioned and supplied? That's a lot of questions. Choose which ones you want to answer.
I mean, obviously water is essential and every zoo is going to make sure that their animals have plenty of available fresh water for supplementing, because some animals can get a lot of water from the food that they eat, or in a few cases, all of it, but many more need to drink. So there's a lot that we can do with the placement of waterers to make sure that the animals have easy access to that, and to consider the behavior, especially of groups of animals, that they're not competing for access, or that, you know, a subordinate animal is afraid to approach the group that's standing by the water. So, you know, making sure there's multiple sources, there's things like that. As nutritionists, we do water testing and, you know, check for levels of minerals and stuff like that to look for anything that might cause a deficiency or a toxicity in some cases. So we make sure that our water supply is safe. And then in the summer, to deal with heat issues, because we're in Florida and it's hot in the summer, We'll do a lot of extra enrichment and stuff like that with water-based foods. So we can, make popsicles with all sorts of the animals' regular diet items, frozen inside ice so that they get a little bit more water. We might add water to their food. We can make gel diets. So these are diets that are kind of like a pelleted diet, except you mix them with water and they've got some gelatinizing substance in them. And so they, form kind of a chewy thing that's a way to give extra water versus just a pellet. So lots of different things to make sure that animals are getting what they need.
Oh, fascinating. And yeah, that kind of corresponds with this rise in the pet food industry with all these approaches to hydrating animals as well. I've always thought that the gels are probably pretty underrated in our kind of pet community as a way to kind of drive in some maybe functional nutrients, but most importantly, probably a lot more hydration. And mm-hmm. So maybe something I think you probably do a lot better job and maybe the ag animal people do too. They, of course, you need a good source of water and a ready source of water for growing animals because they're depositing water as well. But I think a lot of the time we don't do a good job at actually making sure that we educate our pet owners to the importance of water consumption, hydration, considerations around both of those. And I try a lot with my students, at least, to talk to them about the importance of different kinds of waters, automatic waters, measuring the water consumption of cats, and also in ensuring that they do things like clean the water bowl. It is shocking to me when I do one-on-one with horse owners and with pet owners. Sometimes you can just whittle it down to, I don't see your water bowls around here. Where are they? Or I think the best one that I had for horses was some horses that were dehydrated in northern Alberta. And not surprising because all their water sources were frozen. So they were trying to consume snow to procure their water, which doesn't really work. So then... I think maybe as we've talked about substrates, we've talked about diversity. I think maybe now what everybody in the pet industry would want to know, because we're obsessed with nutrient requirements and meeting them, how do you know if your animals are meeting their nutrient requirements?
That is the name of the game, right? As nutritionist is, especially for nutritionists for animals, nobody's published the nutrient requirements of an aardvark. And so, we're developing diets based on an appropriate model species. A large tiger might be similar to a domestic cat. We might use that as a model to at least jump off from. A lot of birds, we can use poultry research, but not all, because we've got carnivorous birds, vultures and eagles and things like that, that, the poultry requirements aren't exactly the same. But as we get further into it. So now we've got diets, they're doing well. We can look at things like the blood values when the vets get blood work. We often review those and look for vitamin and mineral levels and see if they're within expected ranges, if there's anything that's concerning us. And then in addition to that, we look at body condition scoring, which is something that needs to be developed for a lot of species. I mean, if they're a four-legged, something that looks kind of like a domestic animal, where we can use a lot of the domestic ones as a start. But we also have to attach meaning to that. When I think of like the 9-point cat body condition scale that's widely published, like 1, 2, and 3 are considered, unhealthily thin, and 4, 5, and 6 is appropriate, and 7, 8, and 9 is considered maybe a little on the heavy side. And I'm hoping that somebody has validated that. But for our animals, we don't necessarily know that 4, 5, and 6 is ideal. I mean, we can give them a number of 4, 5, or 6 based on their physiology. But what we're finding with some species is that maybe a 2 or 3 is where they're reproductively cycling and their blood work is normal and they're not developing arthritic challenges. And even at a 4, 5, and 6, we're seeing some of the things that we associate with obesity. So for us, it's that challenge of, yes, we can give them a number, but it may or may not mean the same thing that it does for a domestic animal. And so adjusting our scales, or at least adjusting our goals for those animals to be at an appropriate number.
Yeah.
So in addition to body condition scoring and sort of a growing interest in muscle condition scoring, which is sort of a new take on that, we can also look at fecal scoring. So one of the things that I like to do is I have a sieve and I go out and I sieve feces and look for particle size, because especially with herbivores, if they're not chewing appropriately, you'll get these really long fibrous pieces that come through in the feces. And so you can kind of get ideas that way of what's going on with them. And then, you know, you get into more nuanced things like coat condition, any sort of skin condition, things like that, where we can assess it. And then behavior, you know, an animal who isn't showing all of the different feeding behaviors that we talked about earlier, you know, is that us not providing the right opportunities for them? Or is there something going on with the animal that, you know, we can look into? And so that's something, that's a place where we might take a deep dive and look into why they're not chewing cud or stripping those leaves or gnawing on their bones, and work with that.
Interesting. And I am going to remember your poop sieving story. And I may also become a poop siever, because I don't think that anyone, I'm going to have to go look in the literature, but I don't think anybody's applied that to horses. And I think that would be very, very applicable to horses and understanding whether their ingestive behavior is matching the substrates that you're giving. So I think that is a really great idea.
Oh, I think there is quite a bit actually on fecal particle size in horses and ruminants. Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna get into that one in horses for next semester as I teach it, because I do not teach that part. So thank you for that addition to my lecture series.
It's time for our famous three. We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
ICC Animal Nutrition, adding value to nutrition. Trow Nutrition, the science of ingredients, nutrition, and blending. Kemin Nutrisurance is your pet food and rendering partner every step of the way.
Trusted ingredients, proven performance. Wilbur Ellis Nutrition. We partner with a purpose.
ICC Animal Nutrition, a Brazilian company with 30 years of history and present in more than 70 different countries, providing natural, sustainable, and technological solutions for animal nutrition, health, and well-being in a safe and scientific way, adding value in food production and helping to feed the world.
Maybe as a last question before we end today, or the last three questions, I should say, I thought maybe the audience would like to know, what animal is it most difficult to feed, and which is the easiest to feed? And I'm not going to put restrictions on that, because I imagine any of a multitude of things would compromise being able to keep that animal in the way that you want to keep that animal. So I'll let you pick from the myriad of obstacles that I'm sure you're approached with every single day.
So in terms of acquiring feed, the things that are not readily available on the market are probably some of the most challenging for us to acquire. So I already mentioned browse for the browsing animals is something that we pretty much have to develop in-house or with some specialty folks. We've talked about rodents, you know, that's obviously a niche market there. And then insects would be another huge one for the insectivores is some of them, especially like a lot of the reptiles and frogs, need live insects. And so maintaining those colonies or being able to order those regularly. But even larger animals like aardvarks and anteaters are insectivores and We have not been able to come up with a diet that is entirely insect-based. So they have pelleted feeds and things like that. And so, you know, again, to address those behavior issues, are we, you know, we try to capture those behaviors in other ways. Those puzzle feeders for dogs are really fun for animals with long, sticky tongues. you know, so hopefully we're capturing a lot of that and hopefully we're being good mimics of it, but we're not able to commercially source a 100% insect diet for these guys. So I think some of those are the most like challenging to get. In terms of challenging to feed or develop diets for, I personally find the geriatric not eating well animals some of the most challenging. You know, as animals age, kidney issues can make them sort of nauseous and they don't want to eat. Dental issues, you know, and again, we are treating all these, but they still develop them with age. And so, you know, finding things that an old toothless animal or, you know, one who isn't as forceful at working their way to the food, you know, making sure that at least we are offering food in a variety of locations for them so that they have an opportunity to eat on their own without competition, or that we're providing maybe chopped hay instead of long hay for, you know, grazing animals, or making things softer, making things easier to eat, without then messing up their digestion or messing up other things is sort of one of the more challenging aspects, I think.
Well, and I can see it on a staff basis as well. The geriatric animal, the amount of things that you have to monitor and address, it just increases the amount of work to get something that is precisely formulated. When you're feeding a bunch of adult animals, they're a lot more flexible in a lot of things, and so you have a lot more room to play with. But in geriatric animals, it's way less. So that makes a lot of sense to me. They're also the hardest, I think, the hardest to feed in the pet realm as well. And so last but not least, I said it at the beginning, such a cool job. And I know your predecessor quite well. Everybody who has ever led nutrition at Disney has just been so interesting and also just such nice people. How did you get to where you are? What's your biggest piece of advice? If there's people out there studying nutrition and they listen to this and they go, I want to be Heidi Bissell, how do they become you?
So there's very few formal training opportunities for zoo nutrition. So most of the people in our field come from some other direction. Like I obviously came from domestic animal nutrition and wildlife nutrition into the zoo field. Some folks get their start in zoos. They're keepers who've developed a passion, or even vets who've developed a real passion for nutrition and learned about that. We have a few who've come from the field of human nutrition, which is a really awesome background because of the much higher emphasis on treating disease and using diet to address disease in a way that domestic animal nutrition, at least as the historic livestock part, did not. The pet nutrition industry is definitely making huge gains, but mostly for carnivores. So that human long-term management of nutrition diseases is really bringing a lot to our field. So there's lots of different ways. And then zoo experience is important because obviously you just have to know about animals and understand like how zoos work and what's available. And many zoos have wonderful volunteer programs, and we strongly encourage people. Any of the nonprofit zoos will typically welcome, especially in the commissary, to help prepare diets is a great way to get some experience. So that combination of some nutrition background from either the field of animals or humans, and then zoo and animal experience, like real practical experience, would be my advice.
Oh, fantastic. And I said I wasn't going to ask any last questions, but is there something really exciting at Disney Animal Kingdom that you would like to plug to draw us all in for a visit?
We have a very, very adorable baby elephant named Cora, who is growing and doing wonderfully. And you can see her on our safari visit, and it's just awesome.
That's so cool. I imagine that there's probably some good video feed out there as well on that baby elephant. And who doesn't like watching baby animals in general. So, oh, yeah. Well, with that, thank you so much for being with us today, Heidi. And again, thank you to the listeners for joining us. I hope you've had a great time learning about the practical approaches to feeding zoo and exotic animals.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.